I am here with Josh. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Renee.
How you doing?
Well, all the fortune tellers and clairvoyants will tell you I'm happy.
Yes, this is true.
And I agree with them.
All right, get this. So I went last Sunday. This episode comes out on Monday. Not that it's really important to you which Sunday I went, but not yesterday, last week Sunday, to see Lena, the medium whom I see as much as I can, which usually is twice a year because I forget to make appointments with her. And she books out like 14 months ahead. If you tried to make an appointment with her today, you would see her, if you are lucky, in July of 2025. And that's because she's the real deal. I didn't really believe in this stuff. And the first time I went to see her, I had planned on dismantling everything. But instead, I got fucking served. And she continues to just blow my mind every time, and Josh's as well. So what he is referring to when he says, according to all the clairvoyants, he is happy, is that when Lena and I were talking on Sunday, I asked her what was up with Josh, and she said, why is Las Vegas coming up? And I said, because his girlfriend who was living in Las Vegas just moved here. And she said, oh, and then she took a moment and sort of went into Josh, whatever that means when she does that. And then she looked at me really bright-eyed and said, oh, he's happy. And I said, yeah, he is. So that is to what he is referring. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of Malia, that brings me to what I wanted to mention, which is that I was talking, I think, in two episodes ago about Malia making pet food, becoming a pet nutritionist, and now managing SF Raw, which is a raw pet food store in San Francisco, and that she had been working on my dog's menu. And I just got the test back last week. The food sensitivity test I submitted for Chili. This is the longest fucking list of food sensitivities anybody's had since me. Like, before I talk about, I'm going to talk a little bit about food sensitivities in humans. That's my segue out of here. But first, I need to go through this list of things that my dog can't have. Ready?
The dog version.
The dog version of me. Exactly. Beef fat, which we knew it was beef. Malia and I both knew that. So beef fat, there it is. And like, fair, that's gross, right? But the second one, olive oil. The fuck? You can't live in my Italian household and be intolerant of olive oil. That's a sin. The next one's vegetable oil, which, good, because that shit's whack. Oats, same as me. Brown rice? Like, what? The next one's rice bran, so that explains that. Rice flour, soy flour, gluten. That's my dog. Brewer's yeast, evidently. Gelatin. Yeah, that's gross. Brewer's yeast. Yeah. Pea flour? P-E-A flour, people. Because the other one, maybe that too, but powdered cellulose, which, yeah, gross. Tapioca, same as me. And then four specific probiotics. Okay, you ready? The first one is Bifidobacterium infantis.
Hate that one.
I know, that one sucks.
Gets me every time.
I know. The next one is Aspergillus oryzae, which sounds like a vegetable and pasta dish. Like, oh, I had the Aspergillus oryzae. It was delicious. And then Enterococcus faecium, which just sounds like a fancy name for poop, if you ask me. And Trichoderma ricci, which I loved his first album, man. Those raps were tight. And then we get into duck. Ew, gross. Egg white, same as me. Turkey, blech. Chicken, blech. Anchovy, that's a shame because it's really good for him, her, it, everybody. Chili's a her, and I often misgender her because my last dog was him. But anyway, anchovy, halibut, mackerel, mussels, cilantro, because she's smart and cilantro is nasty, parsley, very close to cilantro, citric acid, terrible for the gut, so yeah, of course, ferrous sulfate, which I'm pretty sure is just iron. It's an additive that is iron. Lecithins, yeah, garbage. Manganese sulfate, niacin, omega-3 fatty, sodium selenate, zinc sulfate, beets. All right, Brussels sprouts, carrots, corn, mushrooms, yellow potato, pumpkin, zucchini, and yam. That is a fucking long now. I want to talk about this because this does not mean that she is allergic to all of those foods. She may be allergic to some of them, but it is highly unlikely that if she is allergic to all of them, this was not an allergy test. This was a food sensitivity test. And it works exactly the same in dogs as it does in humans, which is this. Usually, What causes food sensitivities is leaky gut. So if your gut is not in good shape and it becomes leaky, and that just means that the intestine walls are permeable, and this is from all of the garbage in the standard American diet. It happens too from the overuse of certain stomach medications, GI medications. Most of them have pretty shitty side effects. Particularly, I think Prilosec is really bad. But anyway, when your gut is leaky, what happens is that over time, so because the wall of the intestine is permeable, food particles make their way through the wall of the intestine and into your blood. And then over time, as those different foods, the particles of them build up, your body has a like an autoimmune response almost, creates antibodies to attack those food particles, and that's your food sensitivity. So they aren't permanent. The idea is that you do these tests, and I did one when I was really sick, the human version, and I had a ton of these things, and a few of them turned out to be allergies, but most of them were sensitivities. What you do is you have to eliminate everything on the list from your diet, and then you do some sort of gut healing work. And then when your gut is healthier, you reintroduce them one at a time to see which you have a reaction to, or you can just do another test, right? So that's the deal. If Chili continues to eat all of this amazing medicinal food that Malia's making, and oh my God, she made Chili this bone broth that the dog is so cracked out on. She will eat the entire, Josh just watched, entire bowl of bone broth without coming up for air. Like, she fucking loves it. Josh and I are gagging because it's like coagulated.
You hear it.
You're really, you really hear her slurping the coagulated collagen. She loves that shit. But the point is, she stays on that medicinal diet for a while. It will be interesting to see when we retest her how many remain. I'm allergic to egg whites and tapioca and oats. Not allergic, actually. Tapioca and oats, my body mistakes for gluten, so I have my celiac response, and egg whites is an actual allergy. So my guess is she'll just have those, because that would make sense, right? Leaky gut is the source also of things like excuse me, SIBO. It can exacerbate all of those stealth infections like candida. So if you think you have a lot of food sensitivities, don't despair. They're not necessarily permanent. Malia can't make you food. She only does pets, but there is like so much information on the internet about leaky gut and how to address it. So if you're curious, if you have it, take a look there. But your best bet really is to find a functional medicine practitioner and ask them. Somebody asked me this week, speaking of gut stuff, about the celery juice protocol. And I know I've gone over it before here, and also just wanted to remind everybody that there are many episodes of a lot of this stuff. So if you go to the subscriber section of the website, there is like a, it's 12 minutes, I think, a mini episode that I did on the gut healing protocol. So it's just me talking. It's video. There aren't guests or anything. It's just me detailing how to do a do-it-yourself or how to start your gut healing. So you can find it there. We have a great guest to talk to. This is Rob. Rob is a comedian. And sometimes when people tell me that, it makes me nervous because then I feel pressure to find them funny. And sometimes they're not. But Rob is hilarious. Also, Rob comes to us pretty sure that the way he feels, which is shitty, is permanent and that nothing is going to help. And so let's see if we can change that belief. Let's talk to Rob.
How are you?
Pretty well, thanks. Josh is here too.
Hi, Rob.
Hey.
So, Rob, tell me what's going on.
All right. That's a pretty vague question.
You know what? Let's get some background. Let's get some background. We'll start there. How old are you?
I'm 37.
37. Okay. It totally coincidentally, 37 is the most common age for men to start therapy in my practice. Every time I get a new male client and I keep track of everybody, what age they are when they start, 37 is the most common age. So there's something going on around that age for everybody.
Yeah. That's because we start losing our hair and our dick stops working.
That probably has a lot to do with it. Yes.
Yeah.
That sounds about right. Okay. So are your parents still alive?
Yes.
Are they married to each other?
No.
Okay. Well, how old were you when they split?
I was 12.
You were 12.
Yeah. And that definitely fucked me up. I didn't think so at first. Like, I was actually really proud of myself when I was 12. Because I was like, I would use it as an excuse, like at school. I'd be like, oh, I'm so sad my parents are divorced. But I didn't. I didn't actually care. But I realize now it really fucked me up with like relationship. Like I've had, you know, relationships that last over a year, but I wouldn't like call them my girlfriend, you know, it's like always really bullshit.
Right.
Yeah. And I could just never imagine like there's this girl that I was like really into and like then of course as soon as I was like into her, she like decided she's into somebody else, which happens every time. But anyways, I was like, I don't even know if I could have like, fostered, I don't know what it'd be like. I don't want to live with somebody.
Yeah. Right. It's not for the faint of heart, Rob. So let's talk about life until you were 12. Do you have siblings?
Yes.
Okay. How many?
I got two siblings. I'm the oldest. I have a younger sister who's 4 years younger than me. And then my brother's like 6 or 7 years younger than me.
So when you were growing up and your parents were still together, what is your memory of that part of your life? What was it like?
I remember one time we were watching the movie Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah.
And then they're getting a divorce and my dad just turns to me and he's like, this is what your mother wants to do to me.
Oh my God. Really?
Yeah.
Jesus, Dad.
So it was just a lot of just like arguing and like, oh, and then another cool thing. My mom would go to this ladies' night out,
yeah,
like on the weekends, and then my dad would just tell me, like, your mom's out there, fucking firemen.
She's no, a fucking bitch. No, he would not.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, Rob, holy shit. It's funny, but it's not
I don't
not
know why I was always
all.
Fireman. I don't know why I wasn't like car salesman or something.
Nah, it's more likely to be fireman. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Do you remember what you thought when you'd hear that stuff from him?
It made me kind of sick, but I didn't like, it didn't make me mad at him or anything. I just felt like uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
I guess I remember I asked my mom one time what a bitch was.
Oh God.
Because my dad kept calling you it.
What did she tell you? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember that. I actually don't know if I even remember this happening. I just know my mom told
it
to me.
It's one of those. Yeah. Okay. So your parents got divorced when you're in like seventh grade, which is the worst possible timing. Sixth grade. Okay.
Yeah. Sixth grade. Yeah.
Did you go to a school that was 6, 7, 8, 7, 8?
Okay. That's another thing. I went to a lot of schools like from K to sixth grade. I was at this Catholic school that was a K to 8.
Yep.
But everyone, all the kids kept calling me fat and stuff. And it would like suck. So I thought that transferring to a public school would be better. Oh, and then also my friend down the street who's in a public school and like he'd always make fun of me for being in a private school, so I thought like, oh, I need to go to a public. So anyways, I basically like kept complaining about getting bullied and then I also was like, I want to go to a public school. For seventh grade, I went to a different school, public school, and then my mom moved away, and then I went back to a different private school for eighth grade. And then, yeah, so that was the K to 8 experience. And then I went to like 4 different high schools.
Oh my gosh, you did. Why did you go to 4 different high schools?
So the first two, I was doing really bad from like ninth and 10th grade. I was like a class clown type, like always arguing with teachers. I remember one of my teachers called me gay. That was fun.
What?
Yeah. He was like, because I was just like very... I would really piss them off. I was very sarcastic. So I wasn't like the angry divorced kid guy. I was just like, you know, I was just like talking shit and just like cracking jokes, like kind of mess with them. And anyway, so yeah, one of the teachers, like he wasn't a woodshop. He did teach woodshop, but it wasn't a woodshop class. But he was kind of like one of those like gruff guys.
So
he ended up calling me gay.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, so then my mom took me to, she thought that maybe if I went to like an alternative school, that'd be better. So I went to an alternative school and then I just got like really into partying and stuff. And so then as a mutual choice after that, I went to like a boarding school. It wasn't like for bad. It was like to help me, but it wasn't like my mom's like sent me there. It was kind of like my choice. And actually like some people that I was in this like church youth group with at the time, like we're going there too. So it was like,
was it a religious boarding school?
Yeah, it was religious. It was like it was like Christian. And then I got kicked out of that 2 months later because typical stuff. Like I remember I like peed on a guy's door in a dorm. Like it was fun though.
Is that
like, we were
wrong?
Having fun.
Are you not supposed to do that?
Yeah, I guess not. Yeah. It was more of like we were having prank wars and stuff.
Yeah.
But and like everybody liked me there, but I was just once again just like I just never took anything seriously and people didn't like that about me.
When's your birthday, Rob?
October 15th.
What's with the Libras lately, man? March of the Libras on the podcast. Okay. Never took anything seriously. Okay. So does that mean that you didn't take, like, how were your grades at all of these different schools?
They were horrible. I didn't have good grades until I went to college.
Okay. And did you go to college right out of high school?
No, I went like years later. Out of high school, I started selling warranties for cars over the phone.
No shit.
Yeah.
How long did you do that for?
I did it. I mean, I had so many jobs. I did so many like sales jobs and stuff. So that was like for like a year. And I was really good at it. I was making like a lot of money. We were only working like 20 hours a week. This is back in like 06. And I was making like $5,000 or $6,000 a month, just working 20 hours back in 06. And so I was like 18 year old kid making good money.
Yeah,
but then once
great.
I figured out that it was like a scam, basically, then all my, like, I wanted to keep doing it. I was like, it's fine. But all my sales, I just couldn't like, even though I was like, trying to keep doing it. Like, it's not like I was like such a good person that I was like, I wanted to keep doing it, but I just could, you could just, they'd be like, so this covers everything. And I'd be like,
well, everything's a tricky word, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't even know if it's real. I don't even know if it covers anything.
So what got you to go to college?
I smoked a bunch of weed and I was watching like the History Channel and I was like, I think I'm smart. I'm really interested in this stuff. And then like, I don't know. I just was like, I want to learn stuff and learn more. Wow. So I went to school for, I actually went to school for psychology. I didn't keep going, but
okay. But I
did 2 years at community college and then 2 years at Central Washington at like, it was like a satellite campus.
Got it. Okay. You did 4 years, but didn't finish.
No. Yeah. I had 2 semesters left.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what do you do for money now?
I'm delivering pizzas and I do caretaking. I'm a private pay caretaker this lady.
Do you like doing that?
I like the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I've kind of been doing so like there's so much to me. I don't even know if we can cover it all. Like I had a good 10 years of like drug addiction in there.
All right. Let's go there. When did that start?
It started when I was like 22. I was like drinking a lot and partying and then I got a DUI and I had to stop drinking because I also was noticing it. So then I was like, oh, well, you know, I still want to like have a buzz. So then I was like, and then I remember I found like Vicodin in somebody's medicine cabinet. So I like took it and I was like, whoa, this is awesome. Like, I don't drink. I can thrive on it.
Yep. And what could go wrong?
Yeah. And so then pretty soon, like a 5 milligram Vicodin became like 2 80-milligram Oxycontins a day.
That's how it happens so fast, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So fast.
Oh, and then, so then I got on methadone, weaned off of that. Like I got like in a clinic and then there's like the post-acute withdrawals of methadone.
Yes.
And so in order to combat that, I decided I could start taking Adderall.
Oh, Jesus.
And then the Adderall turned into a meth habit.
It can do that.
Yeah. All right. And then, so now I stopped doing meth like 4 years ago. So
you've quit all the hardest drugs to quit. I mean, opiates and meth are particularly difficult and you did it both on the first try.
Well, no, it was more like I quit. And then I actually went to rehab in 2019. I still, had a couple like slip ups after rehab, but I'm not like in a program or anything, but it's been over 3 years.
Wow, congratulations.
Since I did. Yeah.
That's impressive.
So yeah, thanks. But yeah, no, there's definitely I would definitely not say it was the first try, but like as soon as I put my intention towards stopping, it was like I would stop for like, you know, well, once rehab happened, that was when I was like I got my long like 4 months of like just pure sobriety and I realized like, oh, I can be sober and it's fine. Like it sucks, but it's like,
boring as fuck, but it's fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
3 years out. Is it still boring? That usually starts to burn off after a few years.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's I'm the person that I was like afraid I'd be, which is like more boring, but yeah, I'm okay with it. It's not like I'm not feeling bored.
Okay. But, good.
Yeah. But I definitely am boring.
Well, I know what you mean. I'm kind of the same way because I don't drink. I don't go anywhere because everything's booze when you're an adult.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I just lost my job. Let me buy you a drink. I got a raise. Let me buy you a drink. That's what we do for everything. Yeah. 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 Okay. So it's not boring. You're not bored, but you imagine from the outside you are boring. So what do you think you were anesthetizing? What was the feeling you were trying not to have when you were using?
I thought it like, and I think I still do. I think like, I just was like more, it just made me want to be around. Like I'm like I don't like being around people.
So was it like social anxiety?
Social anxiety, but in not even just that, I guess it's anxiety, but even when I'm not anxious, I'm just like, I'd rather just be like reading or
this
something.
This is exactly like, I don't like that about me.
I still don't like it about me. Like I really want to like feel, you know, like be able to get around people and like feel like love and empathy. And like, I do have empathy, but like, I just want, you know, like, I don't know how to, it's just like, I definitely don't get that. And I know it's a real thing. Cause I would get it when I was doing drugs and I see other people have it, like this like delight to be around people, you know, and like I just don't like I just wish I had that, you know. Like,
do you think you had it at one time and it went away?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. And you know what's funny is I'm sure that that's all probably I had it before the drugs and stuff. So like the drugs probably like burned it out of me. And then,
well, I don't know about that, but they may have, it might be buried, but I don't know if it could get burned out of you. But so now these days, if you have to be around people like you, who's your closest? Do you have close friends?
I mean, I have people that think that we're close friends, you know, yeah, like, I mean, yeah, like, but yeah, no, I definitely like, I don't call like, yeah, no, I don't. I have close friends. Oh, that's another thing too. Like these are all people that I've just like only known now for like the past year. Like I've had so many friends that have come and gone. And then actually getting out of rehab, like really traumatized me because, I was finally like, I had these like solid groups of like brothers, you know, like that. And I was like this. Yeah. And I remember I was thinking like, this is crazy. Like one day this was in LA. I lived there for a little while. And I was like, wow, I was like walking around Beverly Hills. I was living in a sober living. And I'm like, wow, this is so cool. Like I have these people that I like actually love. And you know what? It didn't get burned out of me from the drugs. It actually got burned out of me because of this, or maybe not burned out, but whatever. I was like thinking like, oh, you know, I was thinking about all these people I was like so close to. And like, and then eventually they all started like relapsing. And like literally my best friend that I was in rehab with, and we were going to like start a podcast together and stuff. Like he started robbing from me or like stealing from me, and then ended up dying. And then like, so like 23 people that I knew like died within 11 months.
23?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, since you just attached it to that, like it wasn't rehab that burned it out of me, it was this. It is entirely possible that if you didn't fully discharge, if you couldn't experience and discharge that grief, and even if you could for that matter, that you wouldn't want to get close to anybody so that you wouldn't have to go through that again. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And it's like, and it's happened again, like even, you know, I do comedy now. And like, so I actually stayed for like 2 years up, you know, this is like, now we're getting back close to like my age now. Like 2 years after all that, like trauma, I literally just didn't have any, I like moved back to Seattle and I just like kept to myself for like 2 years. And, like I got really like comfortable with it. I liked it. And then I just ventured out and started doing comedy and like all these people, you know, I was just like, I don't want to become friends with you. I would like openly say it. Like, I don't want to get close. You guys are just going to like leave like everybody, you know, okay. I wasn't like being like, yeah, I'm a depressed person, but I'm just saying like, this is how I feel.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we're not. And I even like got a girlfriend and then, but we didn't like, because, I like didn't move fast enough with her. She ended up accusing me of sexual assault, which she wrote a letter to me apologizing. So like I have proof that I didn't
oh
do
my
it.
Gosh.
But I made her mad. So she like started telling everyone in the comedy scene, like, so like basically exactly what I thought would happen did, like the people that, like she was even one, like, I would never turn on you. And I even went through like a really depressed period. And she was like there for me the whole time. And then she used all that information against me. And I like, you know, when she was like there for me, I was like, oh, this is cool. Maybe, you know, so it's like, as soon as I'm like starting to get close to people again, they leave. This last girl that I like hooked up with, and we were like, it was moving way too fast. Like it was like red flag style, but I was like, I was with it. And then I was like, okay, I'm like, I think I actually really like this girl. Like I'm willing to like move fast with her. And then like, then she like left me for another guy. Like it happens. It's not just with girls, but that's just like, obviously the most extreme.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but yeah. So anyways, yeah, everybody I get close to leaves. Like it actually does happen. Like it's an observable fact in my life.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem with experiences like this is that it's not irrational, right? Like it is true. A lot of people that you have been close to have died or have otherwise left you like that. Your brain has actually learned that, which makes it really hard to not give in to that worldview, because like you said, it's not irrational. It's empirical, right?
Yeah.
What's the deal with your parents right now?
They're finally better. So they fought for like, you know, there's like divorce. Every time I go to my dad's house, he would have to tell me, he would yell to me, you know, all these stuff about the attorneys that are all the prices of the attorneys and,
Oh my God.
So there's like, yeah, like 15 years or almost every time I went to my dad's, like, your goddamn mother, she's at it again. But they're fine. He's finally like a little bit better. And they actually like never talk. And now they like, my mom actually got a dog. The dog's dead now. But like, my dad really liked the dog when my brother would like bring it over. And eventually the dog kind of brought my parents back together a little bit, where they can like, you know, my dad will come to like a dinner, you know, if we have a family dinner for a birthday or something, which wouldn't have been the case for like the first 15 years, 20 years.
Okay.
No, wait, that's not quite. Yeah, maybe like 10 years.
What's your relationship like with your mom?
Really good. Yeah, she's it was really bad when I was on drugs and stuff, obviously. Like, I didn't understand what the big deal was, you know. I was like, I just want to get high. I'm not like stealing from you or something. But so she just like was really, so I was like, you know, I was really resentful to her and stuff. And then after doing some work, you know, and then also like getting off drugs, things have gotten, yeah, we're really close.
Okay.
And she actually like a lot of the stuff too, like, you know, like the things I say and the like about my worldview and stuff that she would always disagree with, like she's coming, not about like people leaving me or whatever, but just like how I see the world, like more native, you know. She's like starting to, she's like sees that now we can like commiserate together about how horrible people are.
Oh, good. Great. Okay. All right. So you've referenced a few times at different points, like, oh, it wasn't like I was depressed. I was just like this. And it wasn't like I was so sad about it. And it didn't bother me. And I'm curious, what are the experiences when you are comfortable having contact with like strong feelings?
Well, I like, yeah, I mean, they're bad. I will be that guy, you know, and I don't want to be that guy. So like, I will be like the energy vampire, like, you know, just like I suck, and just like, yeah, no matter what anybody says, it won't actually fix anything. And I'll just feed off of it. So like, because usually my strong feelings are just negative.
I'm hearing strong feelings in terms of like cynicism and things like that. But do you have experiences of like sadness that you have contact with where you actually feel really sad?
Yeah, like with that girl recently I told you about, like that, okay, made me really sad. But then it turned into like really bad depression.
Oh, so okay. So you do have, it turned into really bad depression. How long ago was that?
It was like, this is in November, and then it lasted like until like a month ago.
Oh wow. What how did it lift?
I went back to cynical.
So you left depression by going into cynical, like everything.
Yeah, that's my two options.
It's not me. It's not that I'm terrible. Everything just sucks anyway. So you, yeah, sort of took the, okay. All right. Hey there. It is time for our mindfulness moment. Let's do a grounding meditation. You should, if possible, sit with your back straight and breathe normally. Just take a moment to feel yourself there with your feet on the ground or floor. And now imagine that a foot in front of you, there is a forest of redwood trees. There are just redwood trees that start a foot in front of you and go all the way to the horizon as far as you can see. See them there, and then take your attention to the space behind you. And about a foot behind you, same thing, redwood trees all the way to the horizon. Get them in both places and see them there. And now take your attention to the right side, same thing, a foot out, redwood trees all the way to the horizon. And of course, on your left as well. So once you've placed the trees, take a moment to see and feel yourself there in a small area of protected space with armies of redwood trees on every side of you stretching all the way to the horizon. Take a few gentle, intentional breaths and really feel and see yourself there in that space. Now turn your attention to the soles of your feet, where there are chakras, portals, little circular openings that you are going to dial open really wide. And also from the bottoms of your feet, from the soles of your feet, you are going to send roots down into the ground. Stretch in every direction, wider than you are, literally rooting you to the earth. Send those roots out. Your chakras and the soles of your feet are open, and feel yourself there. Open chakras, rooted to the earth. And now take your attention to the bottom of your spine, to your sacrum, and drop an anchor down to the earth's core. Some sort of cord with an anchor on it, drop it down, hook it to the earth's core. Now, feel how tightly rooted and anchored you are to the earth. Feel that security inside your protected space, redwood trees all around you. And now you are going to start to pull up through those portals in your feet the earth's energy, which is a slow, warm, brown earthen energy. Pull it up through the soles of your feet, and so that You can pull it up through your entire body, but it will move slowly, rising up your calves now. Keep pulling through the soles of your feet, slow, brown, warm, earthen energy, pulling up to your knees, pulling up to your thighs. It's filling your body up from bottom to top. Keep pulling. It's going to go all the way everywhere and keep slowly circulating through your body. So now you're pulling it up maybe to your waist and your chest. Keep pulling that earthen energy up. When it reaches your shoulders, it will start to move down your arms all the way down until it fills up your hands. And then as you keep pulling, your neck will be full, your head will be full. Everywhere in your body, you will feel warm, slow, brown, earthen energy, and you're going to keep pulling it up and circulating it through you. Allow that circulating brown, earthen energy to loosen up anything you want to get rid of. So as you're pulling up that brown, earthen energy, you are also going to use those portals to send down into the earth anything you want to get rid of, any anxieties, self-defeating thoughts, physical distress, whatever you don't want, send it down into the earth. It'll get absorbed and used as fertilizer. And so for the next moment, I'm going to be quiet and you are just going to focus on pulling up that brown earthen energy through the portals in the soles of your feet, feeling it circulate and sending out anything you don't need. Just focus on that. Keep pulling, keep sending out what you don't need. Do that for another moment. Get that last bit of earthen energy in your body, send out that last bit of waste, and then close those portals by dialing them really narrow, really, really narrow. And see yourself there, rooted, anchored, unburdened. Take a few gentle breaths. And let's get back to Rob. So you're just sort of passing around the negativity, whether it's about yourself or the world or other people. It's kind of just like a little.
Yeah. But the cynical one, I feel better. And I can do like affirmations and stuff, even though I don't believe they work. Like I can still.
I don't think they're. I got to tell you, Rob, I don't think they're working. I don't think the affirmations are working. Like, what affirmations are you talking about?
Oh, I don't know. Like, I don't know. Like, I am a successful person. Okay. I'm happy.
Yeah, this is, the thing about this is that these are like cognitive restructuring techniques, right? Like trying to get your brain to stop thinking negative thoughts and start thinking positive thoughts. And the problem with this technique is that you're basically just gaslighting yourself. You're trying to convince yourself of something that you don't actually believe. So the effect is very limited until the root of the problem is removed. And once the root of the problem is gone, then there's actual ground for those ideas to grow roots in and start to feel true. But the ground is still feeding you. Like there is still this constant just feed in your system of like, everything sucks, everybody leaves, everything's terrible, right? So you can do all the affirmations you want and they're really just going to be neutralizing each other, right? It's not necessarily going to get you to feel good. So we got to figure out what the root is. And I have a couple of ideas here, but I'll see what you think. The first thing that's coming up for me is that I would imagine you have a lot of experiences of anger or frustration or annoyance or anything in the anger family. That doesn't mean you necessarily express it. You could be stuffing it away and converting it into someone else. But there's so many places in this story where the boundary problems are huge, right? Like your father's boundaries were super wonky, right? I mean, like really. And so the first thing that we would expect when we see that is that that would have made you angry, right? Well, you said it made you just feel uncomfortable and whatever, and that you weren't mad at him. And I'm curious about that. You said you weren't mad at him when he would say things like that. What did you feel toward him?
Scared.
Scared of him or for him?
Yeah, scared of him. You know, he would never like hit me, but he was very verbally abusive. So.
Oh, he was. What kind of sorts of things did he say to you?
Oh, just like that I'm a piece of shit.
Oh,
or
this
like,
is important.
Yeah, like I'm if I'm like if I like made like left if my room had like a speck of dirt in it, he'd be like, God damn it, it's so fucking messy in here. Okay. That kind of shit.
Okay. So your dad was verbally abusive. And so it's set again with the boundaries, right? Do you think that you believe those things? Do you believe you're a piece of shit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the problem. None of these affirmations are going to root when the trauma-based belief is still, I'm a piece of shit, right?
Like, yeah.
That's just, so the way that this works is traumatic experiences form negative core beliefs, and then we use those negative core beliefs as lenses through which we filter our experiences. So you're growing up, and your dad calls you a piece of shit and tells you your mother's fucking firefighters, which when you're really young, the only way to interpret that is mom doesn't want to be home, and that must have something to do with me, right? You can totally make that about yourself. So you're getting all of these messages growing up that you're a piece of shit. Then you have these experiences in school where, you know, you get kicked out of schools because, well, I mean, I think you get kicked out of schools because schools are not set up to actually handle every learner. You have to learn the way they want or else you're in trouble, right? So you're getting kicked out of schools, but what's the thing that anybody's going to think there? I'm a piece of shit. That's why I'm getting kicked out of schools. And then you're in a relationship and somebody accuses you of something you didn't do. And even though you didn't do it, it's like, why would she do that? Well, I'm a piece of shit. That's why. So you're accumulating proof as you're going through your life. So even though you're getting further away from the time when you lived with your dad and he could say these things to you, the belief is actually becoming more and more entrenched, right? Like it's starting to just, now you have all of this data for the fact that you're a piece of shit. And in addition to that, everybody leaves. So even though you know in your 37-year-old brain that people leave because they had drug problems or because they're pieces of shit or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like the idea is still going to be that people leave you.
Yeah.
So people don't want to be around me. And those of us who like to be alone a lot or who are really comfortable being alone a lot, and I am one of those people, it's a little bit about if someone were to ask me, I would say almost what you said. There is a little bit of social anxiety. I used to have social anxiety, and that's why I drank too. I don't drink anymore, but I would say, and I do say, like, but I really like being alone. And I've spent a lot of time with this because I'm a therapist and I know better. Like, the amount that I socialize doesn't seem normative. Like, it's not enough, right? I don't spend enough time around other people.
Yeah.
And I think that we can, like, sort of metabolize our own self-loathing that we project onto other people into this belief that we really do just prefer being alone. And it sort of becomes that we prefer being alone because being around other people means using all of this energy to try to fight off all of these defeating self-beliefs.
Yeah. Well, that even reminded me too, because like that was another thing. Like before rehab too, I was like I tried AA for a while and they were like, I was, and this is where like I have grown and like things have changed. Like I was like super resentful and like blamed everybody else. Like not like I still do it, obviously, but like not like it's a different way. Like, it's more like a surrender to like, this is how it is. It's okay. Or I'm trying to make it okay. Where before I'd be like really mad because everyone in AA talks about, you know, helping each other and like spending time with them. And then everybody I'd call was like busy or they had like, this is in LA too. So it's like very self-absorbed.
Yeah, yep.
So anyways, then I was just like, this is fucking bullshit. Like, you know, I'm like, so that was another thing. I remember like even like, I thought like, you know, the reason I'm bringing this up, because like the first thought I just had was like, oh, you know, also like in, you know, when you're sober, you don't want to socialize or whatever. But I was like, wait a minute, I did want to socialize, but nobody wanted to socialize back. So I eventually just accepted that too.
Yep. Okay. So far we've got everybody leaves. I'm a piece of shit. So this is your ideas about you in the world are sound, you know, pretty intensely negative, right?
Yeah.
So do you have a therapist right now?
No. I did I was doing therapy back then though, it was like, I was just getting, you know, like Medicare therapy. So it was probably bad.
Yeah, it was
therapist.
Probably shitty. Right.
But yeah, they would just like, one therapist fired me because it's like sort of like back in the school thing. Because she just handed me a worksheet.
Oh, fuck
and
her.
I was like, how does it feel to go to school for 6 years to hand out worksheets?
Rob, you're right. You are. I hate. There is nothing that will send me out of a therapist's office faster than them giving me a fucking worksheet.
Yeah.
Even the one like there's a the times when I've had ADD med prescriptions, one of the psychiatrists who prescribed my prescriptions once did that thing where every appointment you have to fill out this checklist of rating your symptoms.
Yeah.
That makes me violent. It makes me so just ask me. Why? And I know why they do it. Yeah. I know why, and I object to it. I think it's problematic. I, as a therapist, agree with you 1,000%. I cannot stand, unless somebody asks for it, therapists giving people paperwork to fill out anything about themselves. They should be hearing that from you. So yeah, you got fired from a therapist because the therapist was lazy, but you end up thinking, see, here it is. I'm a piece of shit. Therapists aren't supposed to fire people, right? They're supposed to be the one person who can put up with anything.
Yeah.
So all of this is just feeding into it. The other thing is, Talk therapy is going to be really good for you eventually, but right now you need something a little bit different. So we need to figure out where these roots are so that they can be uprooted. And so the way that we would do that is to look for EMDR targets. And EMDR is a trauma treatment. And if we look for the memories you have that either started or deeply contributed to these core beliefs that are so negative, then we can talk about how to get them out. And then once you did that, then regular talk therapy would be effective, or those affirmations would be effective. It would open up the space for you to actually believe some of this stuff, right? So if you think back to, I'm just going to poke around at some memories for a minute and see what we find. If you think back to all the times when your dad said something nasty to you, what's one that sticks out in your mind as particularly shitty, by which I mean when you think about it now, it still makes you feel gross?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's like one of the first memories. And that's another thing too, why like I really struggled in therapy, and like, I don't know, and like, but this one I can actually answer, but there's just like some, I've had so many like, and also with all the drug experiences, like so many different groups of friends and this and that, I feel like sometimes I'm like, I don't remember at all. Like,
yeah.
Like, I don't even, there's somebody like, I had to ask, there's like somebody I did comedy with like 6 months ago, like a lot. And I had to ask my friend what her name was, cause I like completely forgot. I don't know. Anyways, that's just kind of how I think it might be like another trauma thing. Like, I'm just like, I'm really good at like, just like pushing that shit away and forgetting. But anyways, I can answer this question. It's one of my first memories. It's when I was like 2 or 3 and I spilled milk and my dad just like went off on me, like just like cussing me out, like so mad. And I remember feeling like such a bad person because I spilled milk. And then I would like cry sometimes if I spilled like at a friend's house.
Of course you would. All right. And tell me this, if you go back to that memory and you imagine that you're in your 2 or 3 year old body, and dad's yelling, right? You've spilled the milk and you're sitting there and your father's yelling and you remember being in that little body. On a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is no distress at all, 10 is the most distressed you've ever felt. When you remember this, what number does it feel like?
Probably like 8.
There we go. So let me explain what's going on here, Rob. That was perfect. This was actually, you, for all of the times that you feel like you failed therapy, you're about to get an A+ for this one, because you just served me up the most perfect possible EMDR target memory. Because the way that EMDR works, I've explained it before on the podcast, so I won't go into the whole thing. Everybody gets a free follow-up session with me after the podcast, so if you want me to explain it, then I can. But I'll just sort of go over it a little bit more quickly now. EMDR works by changing the way your nervous system is storing memories, because traumatic memories get stored in a different place than regular memories do. So the process of EMDR basically moves the memories out of the trauma spot into the regular spot. It reprocesses them. But what's really important about that is all trauma memories are stamped with an I am. They all either formed a negative core belief or endorsed a core belief. So up in your right brain memory, where your trauma memories are, you have all of these snapshots flying around. Trauma memories are snapshots. They are not full stories the way normal memories are. They're just little Polaroids. You have all these Polaroids flying around that are stamped on the back with negative core beliefs. So some of them are stamped with, well, let me ask you, when you're sitting there and your dad's yelling at you, you're 2 or 3 years old, complete this sentence for me. I am what?
A fuck up.
A fuck up. Perfect. So at 2 or 3 years old, that experience with dad formed the core belief, I am a fuck up. And we already know, because you've told us the hundreds probably of life experiences you've had, that you could then filter through that lens and be like, that happened because I'm a fuck up. So that one's really strong. It has a lot of proof. There's probably a lot of Polaroids flying up there that say, I'm a fuck up. So the way that triggering works is that anytime in your daily life, your present life, you encounter a piece of sensory stimuli, a sound, a sight, a smell, a feeling that matches one of your Polaroids, and since you have a lot of them, that's going to happen a lot, your right brain accesses that memory, and then whatever the emotion is, all trauma memories, those little Polaroids that are flying around, they have two things on them. They have a sensory memory and an emotion. And then on the back, they have the I am stamp. So when your right brain grabs onto one because it has a piece of stimuli that matches a piece of stimuli in your present environment, we get flooded with whatever the emotion is. And that's what being triggered is. So anytime anything in your present matches one of those Polaroids, any experience that endorsed this idea that you're a fuck up, you're going to be flooded with that feeling. And your response to that feeling used to be to anesthetize it, do drugs. You don't do that now. So your response to that feeling is to isolate. If nobody can see me being a fuck up or reflect it back to me, I'm safe. I don't have to rub up against it, right? It's a lot easier to be a fuck up in a vacuum, right?
Yeah.
So it all makes a lot of sense now why you would go from using to isolating, why it would feel easier to be alone. And the way to stop that, or the way to start changing that, is to have someone do EMDR. And you're in Seattle, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Have someone do EMDR for you. And this could be me, or this could be somebody we find you in Seattle. Like I said, we can talk about it later and get it figured out. We always do. Find somebody who can do EMDR and they would change this. What happens in EMDR is that all of the memories that say I am a fuck up on them in your right brain get reprocessed and turned back into regular memories, and the I am a fuck up gets taken off of them. I do it all the time. It sounds like voodoo when you actually explain it. It's very hard to imagine that it really works, but it's evidence-based. They use it in the military. It's fucking brilliant. Got millions of, I don't have millions, I'm totally hyperbolic and exaggerating, but maybe close to 1,000, but definitely hundreds of people that I've done it with, and hundreds of people who have done it with other people who can tell you how fucking earth-shatteringly brilliant it is. It's like an absolute miracle. Because right now, like you know because you're living it, no matter how many affirmations you do, you still think you're a fuck-up. And you think that because there's this strand in there of real truth. Your own brain is telling you it's the truth. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, and also too, I'm scared. Like if I did all this stuff and then it did actually fix it as far as how I'm experienced, but then like, it turns out I was right all along.
Yeah, right.
And then it just like hurts more, you know?
Exactly. Like, let's just leave it trauma so that at least I know it's irrational. But yeah, what if we go and we fix this and then you know, everybody's like, no, you actually are kind of a dick. Yeah, that would suck. I got to tell you, Rob, I'm pretty sure that's not the case.
Yeah.
We'd love to call you an asshole.
We would.
You can call me gay. My teacher did it.
I would love to call you a gay asshole. But
that's the best kind.
Exactly.
Now I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, about calling people assholes. Yeah, no, I don't think that's the case, Rob. I feel pretty strongly that it's not.
Okay.
But the point is, I feel like as certain as I can be that if these strands got pulled out, you would not be like, oh, I actually do suck. Now, that doesn't mean that isn't going to be something you're going to have to work on, because what happens is you pull the trauma strand out and it's not like everything changes. It's not like, but because the thoughts and behaviors that you have been practicing for decades while you were living with this unresolved trauma in your body, those become habits of mind. Right.
Yeah.
So, but the difference is that once the trauma strands are gone, then the affirmations start to work. Then the talk therapy starts to work. Then the other things that people have probably suggested to you that you've been like, yeah, whatever, that doesn't make a difference. Then those things start to make a difference. So you would still need to do a little cleanup on the sort of worldview that you've built in your brain. You know, these categories around other people and yourself. And then there's another piece of this, though. We can take out the I'm a piece of shit or I'm a fuck up or whatever, however you want to call it. And that would be huge. And then there's another big piece in here, which is grief. You have unresolved grief stuck in there. And the thing about negative emotions is that they're not inherently problematic. Negative emotions come up as signals. They're telling us that something needs attention. They want us to do something. Grief is relatively simple, which doesn't make it easy. All grief really wants us to do is grieve. But with any negative emotion, grief, anxiety, anger, sadness, whatever it is, if we don't attend to it, it'll get stuck. It's supposed to come up, and as we're attending to it, it sort of moves through us and eventually out of us. But if we push it away or we over-intellectualize it or we don't deal with it, however that is, it tends to sort of park itself in our systems. And you've got this grief parked in there that's sort of socially prohibitive, right? Makes you not want to be around people for fear of caring about them and then having to lose them. And so in addition to any trauma that might be attached to that, there might be another EMDR target in there, like I am alone or something like that. In addition to any trauma content that would need to be resolved in order to clear that up, you'd have to go through an actual grief process. right? And nobody wants to do that. It's not that much fun. But what grief needs in order to move through us is it always needs two things. It needs community and it needs ritual. So it would mean being able to lean on someone, having someone in your life who could support you while you discharged that grief. Is there anyone that you're close to and comfortable being emotional around?
I don't know, maybe my mom or something.
Okay, that works. Yeah, mom would work. And the other thing is, it doesn't have to be right away. You could do the trauma work, and then outside of the trauma work, maybe take some time trying to grow some relationships with people. Although, to our point here, what's getting in the way of building relationships, it's 50% you thinking you're a piece of shit, and it's 50% you expecting that people will leave.
Yeah.
Right? So it would be, it's going to take a little, probably pushing against some of that in order to spend time with people. Do you have the opportunity to, like, if you wanted to be around people more, could you?
Oh yeah. Okay. No, there's like tons of annoying people that always want me around and stuff.
I can hear my mentor in my head right now that if he were here right now, what he would say is he thinks everybody's annoying because he expects that they find him annoying. That's what he would think, right?
Yeah.
You think that's true?
No, I think
I don't
that,
either. I don't either.
Yeah. Like I said, I honestly, this is all based, like, because I feel like if I could have met these people, like, but see, I don't think I would have been able to. I don't know. It's just like, so, you know, things are what they are. Like, because I, the reason I believe that, even though I'm like, you know, therapy never works or whatever, like, I'm still open minded to like trying new stuff. I just don't have any hope. I'm open-minded to it because, you know, I'm definitely like, I was super, like, before I tried, like, did, you know, so there's still some of the stuff I learned in AA that I apply because I used to be way more resentful towards people. And like, I'm just not, and I was just like, so like, and that's why, so like, that's, I think why people didn't want to hang out with me. Cause like, I wanted them to hang out with me right now when I want
right,
them to hang out.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like, I learned that, that was the part that I was playing. And then once I kind of fixed that, like, things did change and now people do want to be around me, but it's like, I already built up my walls.
Yeah.
And so now I'm like, I don't want, and like, it sucks. Like, it's like, oh, I got all these people that want to be around me, but I don't really want to be around them anymore. So now that's annoying. It's like, they're like knocking at my walls.
And on that note, it is time for another mindfulness moment. Let's do our standby cyclic sigh breathing. We will do 7 of them. You know how it goes. The count sounds like this. Inhale, hold. Inhale, full. Exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In through your nose, out through your mouth. Try to get that first breath in your belly only. And then the second breath, do whatever you have to do to get more air in. Use your shoulders, use your chest, whatever works. On the exhale, please try to empty your lungs completely. That's where the magic is. So I count, you breathe, ready, and inhale, hold, inhale, full, exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Inhale, hold, inhale, full, exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Inhale, hold. Inhale, full. Exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Inhale, hold. Inhale, full. Exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Inhale, hold. Inhale, full. Exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Inhale, hold. Inhale, full. Exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Inhale, hold. Inhale, full. Exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Let's get back to Rob. What about dating?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know, like, it's dating's, like I said, it's been tough. Like, it's very rare. I go on dates and I just don't feel any spark a lot of the times. And then when I do, it's like there's no spark back. And then, like, there's been like 2 times now. This is when I get really depressed where there was a spark. And I was like, okay, it's like working. Like, this is great. And then all of a sudden they just like, something happens. Like, and okay. I don't know. Yeah. So, like, it's like super rare for me to like find that girl that I'm like, okay, I really like this girl and like there's chemistry. So I go on a lot of dates and it's just like, it actually sucks. Cause I'm like, oh, there's, you know, they're pretty, they seem cool, but I'm just like, I'm just not into it. And I can't even like fake my way through it till it becomes something real. I don't know.
That's okay. Yeah, that's all right. But you're willing, do you have any hope there? Are you willing to try?
I don't know. That was scary. Cause okay. like I get really, I'm very like sensitive. Like this last girl, like I said, I was like, screwed up.
Well, yeah, that's reasonable under the circumstances.
Yeah, and so like it's just like it feels like I'm just, if that happens again, it will probably happen again, like that's how life works, but like if that were to happen again soon, like tomorrow or something, I don't even know.
I get you. Like, you know, okay, so what I just heard from you is that it's not that I'm not willing to try, but I know myself well enough to know that if the same thing happened to me that happened last time, that would break me forever.
Yeah.
Like, there's a little bit of hope left, but it feels so fragile that if anything happens to it, it's the last piece you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, to my earlier point, there are probably other trauma strands in here. In addition to I'm a fuck up, well, we could find out right now. Let's go to, you lost 23 people in 11 months. Is that what you said? I think that's what you said. Okay.
Yeah.
23 people in 11 months. Which of those losses was the hardest? Who?
My friend CJ. He was like, my best friend in rehab. Like, he's a guy that ended up, he started stealing from me, or, and then like
that one. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's imagine that your entire relationship with CJ, starting from when you met and ending with when he died, your entire relationship with him was a movie and we're watching it. And I tell you, all right, I want you to press pause at the moment that was the worst for you. What would we be looking at?
It was when he borrowed. He'd already been up to like, he already owed me like $2,000, and then he borrowed and he's like, oh, you know, he said he'd never do it again or whatever. And then he like called me and he desperately needed like another $200 for a hotel or something. And I did it, but then I was like, I'm not even going to answer this guy's phone call anymore. It's like all that stuff, that all that friendship and like good times, that was all fake and a lie. And
So now you've pressed pause at the moment that's the worst for you, which is when you're realizing this or you're finding this out or he's asking or whatever. And so the same thing we did with the spilled milk memory. If you close your eyes and you imagine you're back in your body and that's happening, you're realizing that. On a scale of 0 to 10, 0 no distress at all, 10 is the most distressed you've ever felt, what number is it?
We'll go 9.
Shit, dude, you've got so much stuff in there that would work for EMDR. Okay. And in that moment, in that charge of a 9 moment, what's the I am? I am what?
I am like a fool.
I'm a fool. There you go. There's 2. I am confident that if we kept playing this find the EMDR target game, we'd probably find 2 more. My guess is you've got 4, but you definitely have 2. So when I ask you, are you interested in hanging out with people? Are you interested in dating? And your honest answer is no. We have no idea what your answer is going to be when all of this trauma gets resolved. That's going to change a lot of stuff because there's a lot of it in there. That 9, the I am a fool, is also in there pumping that what feels like truth to you all the time. These I am statements that we pull out in EMDR, what's so brutal about them is that they are always false, but they feel entirely true. And your brain believes it has the evidence. And if you believe in astrology, you're a Libra, you're an air sign, you are overly reliant on your brain. So it's going to be really hard. It's hard for any of us not to believe something our brain's telling us. We've been led to believe that the brain's where truth is. It's not. It's in the body. But brain tells really good stories, and it's telling you some really shitty ones all the time. So really what you need is some hardcore trauma treatment. You need a bunch of EMDR. I don't know. What's your relationship with psychedelics?
Yeah, I know. I've done a lot of psychedelics.
Like psychedelics from a therapeutic dose of mushrooms. But EMDR does the same thing. So it's not necessary to do both. Although sometimes it's the
yeah,
work
I mean, I, yeah, I don't know. I've done, like I said, I got to the point where like I've done so many psychedelics that I don't even believe they're therapeutic anymore.
All right. Well, what's the highest dose of mushrooms you've ever done?
4 grams.
All right. Well, I usually start therapeutic doses at 5, so we don't know yet. We don't know what would happen, okay? Here's what I think. I think that the first thing, the best thing for you to start with would be EMDR. And the great thing about EMDR is it's not a lot of talking. It's a pretty straightforward process. You don't do a lot of talking in it other than just setting up, which we've almost completely done already, setting up what the targets are. So you're in Seattle. I have a couple clients in Seattle. I can find you someone up there. And when we, if we have a follow-up session, we could talk about it. I can also do it for you. After the EMDR is done, if you do like 2 or 3 of these, a lot of stuff is going to shift. And it's likely that it's going to open up some space for you to actually want to have people in your life. Not necessarily a lot, and not necessarily all of these people who want to hang out with you. I believe there's some truth to the fact that you're harder to place than the average person. Right? It's going to take, like, I'm the same way. Like, I don't meet that many people that I want to spend time with. And it's not because there's anything wrong with them. It's really about me and my sensitivities.
It's just, I feel like they're, I don't know, like, without being, they're basic, you know, or whatever. Like, it's just people, I don't know, just like the stuff that they care about, I just could give a shit about.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I mean, do you have ADHD?
I mean, well, I got diagnosed with it, but also I wanted Adderall, so... but I'm pretty sure I do. I think I definitely have it. I've also been accused of being autistic, but
of autistic. I was going to say to you, you sound like, and this is me, which is why I'm recognizing it, and my kid. It sounds to me like you have this, like, it's just neurodivergence. I don't care anymore about if it's autism, if it's ADHD, if it's sensory processing disorder.
I don't give a fuck, but you're neurodivergent.
And those of us who have the flavor of neurodivergence you have, which is me and my kid among our two of the people who do it, this, we are picky socially. It's hard for us to be comfortable around everybody. There are certain people that we can be comfortable with. My experience is that the people that I enjoy, I can be around 24/7, but there are very few of them.
Yeah, definitely.
And everybody else I can't tolerate at all for more than 5 minutes, unless they're my clients. So I know this thing.
Yeah,
I know
if they're paying me money, then I'll hang out.
Well, and I love all my clients. I don't work with anybody I don't like for this reason, but I've gotten to choose them, right? Like, I don't take everybody who comes to me. But my point is just that I recognize this orientation toward the world that you have. And I don't think that you're going to turn into somebody, if we do some trauma work, who wants to hang out with everybody. You're still going to be very selective. But within that selective pool, you'll have motivation to connect the way that you connect. Right. And that's about, my kid has gone through this. I have gone through this. It's hard to find the right people. It's a lot of trial and error. And that can be really demoralizing.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's just there. We're hard to place. Hard to place in a relationship super comfortably, but they're out there, especially now that everybody thinks they have autism, right? There's probably tons of people who at least think, right?
Well, now, then they'll be even more annoying. So, like, you don't have it.
They will be even more annoying. That's right.
Did you figure it out from TikTok? You don't have it.
And let me guess, your last partner was a narcissistic abuser who gaslit you, right? And you have autism. The TikTok
you're
special.
You're an empath.
You're an empath. Oh my God, you're my favorite. Yes, you're an empath. That one really fucking yanks my chain. Seriously, I write about it all the time on Instagram, and half of the comments are rageful. It's half the people who call themselves empaths get really mad when I say there's no such thing.
Oh, but, yeah. No, yeah. They are. That's just so my favorite part about it. That's the thing, too. I'm like, if the world is a mirror and everybody you see is a narcissist, you know, maybe you're not
exactly
an empath.
That's good. People don't like that, though, Rob. You know that. They don't like to hear
it. Yeah, no, I don't do that anymore.
No.
I don't tell the truth as much as I'd like to.
No, you don't want to fuck people up with the truth. The truth really messes with people. Nobody likes a truth teller. That's why, I get in a lot of trouble for that myself. What's your relationship like these days with your dad?
I got to keep him at arm's length. Like, he actually, speaking of, like, he actually came over today to my place and just, like, immediately started. It's actually really clean. But it wasn't clean enough for him, but he didn't it's cool. If I just let him act how he acts but don't respond, he'll get better. So like, we're good, but I just have to be like very like discerning and like careful.
Okay.
But if I am, then that's actually like a good experience.
Okay. So it's a little laborious, right? It's not easy. It's okay, but it's not easy. But mom, it's easier with mom.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, good. So if I asked you if you had a support system, it would mostly just be mom?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like I said, there's like people, like I have my friend, Steven, you know, he's like, adores me, but like, once again, he's not one of the really annoying people. Like, but like, he could be one depending on the day.
Right. Anybody can be one depending on the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I get you. I know.
But yeah, no, I don't know if I keep people so far away at this point. I just don't know. I have them though. I definitely have people like a well of them I could grab from. I just don't know if I like actually trust them or not, because I haven't really gotten it.
Right, because you don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I feel highly motivated to intervene on this, Rob. I got to be honest with you. So if we can get you some EMDR, right, which I know we can, it's just a matter of what works best for you. And I would recommend doing that first and then seeing what space opens up. I don't think the goal is for you to be this like gregarious extrovert who's constantly having house parties with people, but just to have a handful of people who, like the friend you were just talking about.
Yeah, no, like you said, I mean, I want that. Like, that's another thing I hate about myself is like, I know what I wish I was.
Okay. So here's another thing I just heard that will be good practice, something you can work on in the meantime while we're figuring out the trauma stuff. The only way, so you've got all of these unintegrated parts, we all do, right, until we heal. Like, all of these parts that are rested at ages that were difficult for you. So, like, there's a 2 and 3-year-old in there who got yelled at for spilled milk. There's all of the, not all, but, like, any of the ages when really difficult things happened, you likely have parts in there that correspond to those ages. And the thing about unintegrated parts of the self is that they're, like, full personalities. They have their own, like, wants and needs and things. And that thing that happens to people, like, when something happens, you're like, I don't know why I acted like that. I don't know what came over me. That's usually because a younger part has gotten triggered, because what happens is, until they're integrated, they're kind of in the back. Like, if we're driving a station wagon, all the unintegrated parts are in the back seat. Each of them is holding either a wound that needs to heal or a need that hasn't been met. That's what each of those parts is holding. And that's why they're not integrated, because of the wound or the unmet need. When they're not integrated, they can grab the wheel, by which I mean they can take over our behavior at any point. Right. So if one of the parts that lost somebody, that feels like I'm a fool or I'm alone or whatever, gets activated, gets triggered, and starts grabbing the wheel, it's going to shut you down. It's going to tell you, like, everybody sucks, don't go out, they're not going to like you, whatever the messages are to keep you away, right? In order to change some of this behavior, we need to get those parts healed and integrated. EMDR will do some of this, but some of this is going to take some direct work. And the way that you start to work on soothing those parts is like this. When you get triggered, when you're feeling like, you know, what's the friend that you just mentioned? What's his name? CJ, Steven, the one who's lost.
CJ or Steven?
So, like, Steven calls or something, right? And you feel this thing come up in you where it's just like, nah, I'm not going to call, or I don't want to interact, or whatever the thing is that tells you you're having a response to that. When your reaction right now is to hit yourself, that's going to make it impossible to integrate these parts, because the only tricky thing about integrating parts is that you have to love them to integrate them. You have to have compassion for them. So the real work for you, and I know this is probably challenging at this point, is going to be finding compassion for yourself by finding compassion for the younger parts. That makes it a little easier. You don't have to have compassion for 37-year-old Rob yet, but for the younger pieces. So when you feel like you don't want to do something socially that someone has asked you to do, and you start to go to, God, I'm such an asshole, I hate this about myself, instead, picture yourself at the age you think you were when that wound first hit, right? So picture younger Rob. And I know this sounds corny as fuck, but I promise you it works, like, brilliantly, is to look at that younger part, like, actually picture yourself at that age and be like, dude, of course you don't want to. We have every reason to think this is going to go bad.
Yeah.
I totally get it. I think hopefully we're going to be able to do this differently soon, but it's all right. Today we'll stay in. It's fine.
Yeah. I'm not, as corny as it sounds, like, I've actually, like, on mushrooms, I've done that.
Excellent. Excellent. Exactly. All the more reason to try it when you're not. It'll work.
Yeah.
If you can intervene on the self-loathing responses and change them into compassion. And the easiest way, you have contact with it because the mushrooms taught you, which makes perfect sense to me. I fucking love that. Exactly the way the mushrooms taught you to soothe the younger part, that's going to open up some space for you to actually make changes in there. Because as long as you keep telling yourself that you're an asshole for feeling that way, those parts are never going to heal.
Yeah.
Because that's why they're outside in the first place. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So while between now and when we talk, practicing that, practicing looking for the places where you can talk to a younger part and tell it it's okay that it's feeling the way it is rather than hate yourself, that's going to go a long way. Like, that's going to be way more helpful than any of those affirmations at this point.
Yeah. So I can just be like, it's your dad's fault.
No, you can. Yeah. No, this is that I'm glad you said that. Trauma healing, there's a trajectory in healing childhood trauma as it relates to our caregivers. You have to feel the anger. Then you'll feel the grief and then you'll be free.
Yeah.
So you have to be mad at your parents at least at some point, right? Or your dad at least. Like, yes, you can say that was dad's fault. You can even say when you hate yourself, shut up, dad. Because that's where that voice came from.
Yeah.
Like, if you make a mess and you're like, I'm such a fucking slob, like, dad, shut up. That's whose voice that is. You couldn't get angry when you were a kid. We can't really be too mad at our parents or the world falls apart. But that anger, because anger's job, that spiel I was giving you before about all negative emotions have jobs, anger's job in every situation is to tell you that there's a boundary problem. And the reason anger has heat, the reason it's so activating, is to give us the energy to reset or change or restate or take down the boundary or do whatever the boundary work is, because people hate it when we do that. But my point is that the anger is what's going to allow you to create the appropriate, like, concrete or emotional boundaries with dad, so that either you probably don't need them anymore, the concrete boundaries. Like, I need you to not say things like that to me. If he has stopped doing it, what you need is an emotional boundary that will partly be created through EMDR and partly through the other work, so that you don't internalize that stuff, right? But you need to be mad first. Mad's fine. And then we'll get to the grief part where you get to discharge the grief. We have to open up the space for that. And then you're going to step into something very different that you can't even imagine because you haven't been there yet. But it's there. I can see it for you. Like, you can get, like, this all makes perfect sense. Like, I think you said something when you messaged me, like, I'm never going to figure it out or something like that. Like, we can figure this out. I can see these points, how they connect and how they've gotten you where you are, and I know how to get you back down.
Yeah, it seems like you know what you're talking about.
I do. Thanks, Rob. Thanks.
She does this for a living.
So did the lady who handed me that worksheet.
I'm saying, yeah,
I guess
that's
doesn't mean shit.
No, but that's exactly why we do the podcast, because so does the lady who handed you the fucking worksheet. There is so much bad therapy out there. So much. And people get really demoralized, like, it doesn't work. And it's like, no, it doesn't work if your therapist is a robot idiot. No, it doesn't work under those circumstances.
Yeah.
You're right. But if you get a human being therapist who actually knows what they're doing, it's fucking life changing, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to get this work done. We're going to get this work done. We'll get you some EMDR. We'll get you started on all of these other things.
And cool. Free EMDR. That's going on the gratitude list. See,
there you go. That fucking gratitude list that doesn't mean shit yet. Put it on there anyway. Rob, this was really fun.
Thank you. I feel really good about this. And yeah, like I said, I'm not just like, I feel, yeah, you like said some things that I'm like, oh, wow, that's that makes a lot of sense.
That's what I'm here for.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, Rob. It was great talking to you, and we will talk soon.
All right, talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye. 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 Bye.
You have been listening to Psychotherapist. If you would like to be a guest on the show, head over to our website, psychotherapistthepodcast.com, and send us a message. Or you can find me on Instagram, psycho_therapist_Renee. See you next week.